Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for tuning in this week. I'm Jared Serbu. We have a special edition of On DOD this time around. Three guests from the Defense Information Systems Agency join us this hour to talk about various aspects of cloud computing. And all three of them are also joining us for a free online chat with our listeners. Later in the hour, Carrie Burris, the program manager for Forge.mil, will be with us to talk about that open source software development platform and some recent upgrades to the service. We'll also hear from Julie Mintz, DISA's cloud service director. She'll give us the latest on MilCloud, DISA's private cloud offering for DoD customers. First, though, an update on cloud security. While DISA is no longer the exclusive cloud broker for the entire Defense Department, it is in charge of setting security standards for commercial cloud providers within DoD. Roger Greenwell joins us for this part of the program. He's DISA's cybersecurity director. He joined me by phone from DISA's headquarters at Fort Meade. We start with an update on DISA's provisional authorization process for commercial cloud service providers.
So today, I believe we've issued approximately 34 authorizations at level 2 and 2 authorizations at level 4. As you know, what we've tried to do is create some efficiencies in our processes for how we do provisional authorizations at level 2. So now we take advantage of the FedRAMP process and be able to actually issue provisional authorizations at level 2 just as soon as they actually complete FedRAMP, whether that's an agency ATO or going through the FedRAMP JAB. So we've definitely been able to speed up the process and take advantage of that.
So why is that? If it's more or less automatic, and first of all, tell me how automatic it is to get that level 2 DoD provisional authorization once you've run through the FedRAMP gauntlet. But if it is more or less automatic, why even have the DoD provisional authorization process at that low security level?
Well, the real reason for it is it does give us an ability that if there were to be an issue with one of the cloud providers, that DoD has a way to, if you will, I'll say revoke that provisional authorization or to put some caveats or other requirements behind it just in the event of an issue. So that's why DoD has done that. And plus, it provides consistency all the way across the board when we look at, you know, levels 2, 4, 5, and 6, all of our different cloud levels, for everybody to be able to go to one source, see the provisional authorizations, and know what levels they're at in DoD, I think just makes it easier for our community.
And as a cloud service provider, do you need to make, let's say, a separate application to DISA once you've received your FedRAMP approval in order to get your DoD provisional authorization, or is it literally automatic?
No, it's actually literally automatic. We go through, and again, as soon as the FedRAMP processes it, we go ahead and work to place it onto the DoD provisional list. It usually happens within a few days of actually completing out the FedRAMP process. Our team here is actually works very closely with the FedRAMP program office because, of course, DoD is one of the three members of the FedRAMP JAB. So we're involved working with that program office daily. So we keep a sharp eye on when things are coming through and get the provisional authorizations ready for DoD to issue.
Understood. That definitely helps clarify, because I think there is a sense in some corners of industry that DoD is still adding on its own layer of the process just to issue the provisional authorization. But that still, once you get it, doesn't authorize you to immediately go sell cloud services to DoD customers, right? What's involved in getting the actual authority to operate within DoD?
So it really depends upon the requirements of the actual mission system itself. So what we were just mentioning was the impact level 2 and where how DoD is taking advantage of what comes through FedRAMP. But certainly some mission systems, if they handle a controlled unclassified information or national security systems, then there are additional controls that DoD places on those evaluations, a process that we call FedRAMP Plus. So in those cases, we are going to look for certain additional controls to be evaluated. And what we try to do is we use the same assessors that are supporting the FedRAMP process and doing the FedRAMP Plus process so that, again, everybody has a better knowledge of each other and work through that process a lot quicker. From a sales perspective, a cloud provider can offer services to DoD with a provisional authorization. The mission owner ultimately has the responsibility to issue the authority to operate. And the reason that that's done separately is that the provisional authorization looks at the core controls that are required, but it doesn't consider fit and function for a particular mission. Our assessment doesn't consider availability as part of the requirements, and those are really controls that are at the mission owner's level to evaluate and decide what's appropriate for them. Also, the other big factor in this is what type of service is it? Are we talking about infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, or software as a service? So if it's infrastructure, more and more of those controls are still the responsibility of the mission owner itself. The underlying infrastructure may have a provisional authorization, but the mission owner may be the one that's actually placing their application or system operating above that infrastructure, and therefore they have the responsibility to make sure that their mission system is configured properly and everything's acceptable for that particular mission. Even in cases of where we talk about things like software as a service, naturally we're trying to assess more and more of the controls at the software as a service level, but there still will be some requirements that ultimately that mission owner is going to have. So again, they will have to make sure that it's for a particular fit and purpose and that all of the requirements are acceptable to them from a mission perspective. And they're the ones assuming the ultimate risk because, again, it's for their particular mission. The goal with the provisional authorizations is to make that process much more efficient for them and for the department as a whole to be able to leverage the artifacts that are produced as part of the provisional authorization.
So two authorizations at impact level four, I believe you said, is, and I gather that would require the FedRAMP Plus process with DoD's specific security controls, right?
That's correct.
And
so,
go ahead. No, I was just going to ask you to give us a flavor for how rigorous, how additional, how much you're layering on top of FedRAMP at that level.
There are a number of controls that we have actually on top of that. You know, what we do is we look at the additional level of controls, depends upon, again, whether there's infrastructure as a service, software as a service, or platform as a service as to the specific number of controls. The goal, again, is to be able to assess those, you know, leveraging the work that the cloud service provider brings through their 3PAO, their third-party assessing organization. So one of the things that we try to do is when people come in and say they're going to work through the FedRAMP JAB, if they are interested in working at a level 4 or 5 in the DoD space, we try to begin that process right then so the cloud service providers can engage their third-party assessing organization and evaluating those DoD controls as they're doing their actual FedRAMP baseline. So ideally, as close as possible, the FedRAMP documentation requirements, the artifacts associated with that, and our FedRAMP Plus artifacts are all available near at the same time. And again, creating efficiencies for both ourselves as well as the cloud service provider itself.
And if you're a vendor whose eventual goal is to sell cloud services to DoD and you're just starting the FedRAMP process, are there particular advantages to going the Joint Authorization Board route versus the agency ATO route and getting 3PAOs involved? Are there any pluses and minuses to which way you go through the system?
So from our perspective, we are absolutely looking for a 3PAO evaluated FedRAMP authorization. There are, you know, some differences between an agency ATO and a FedRAMP JAB ATO. I would tell you from our perspective, the we place a lot more level of trust and fidelity on the work that goes through the FedRAMP JAB because of the involvement of the three communities that are involved in reviewing the artifacts. With an agency ATO, we do accept that for level two, recognizing that, again, if those agencies have granted an ATO and it's based upon an approved 3PAO doing performing that assessment, then we have a high degree of confidence in that authorization for, again, level two. Part of the requirements we have then is making sure that we, again, understand what are those potential risks for that cloud service provider, even at a level two, and we be able to share that with potential DoD mission owners who may want to use that cloud provider. It, you know, whether those risks are acceptable to that mission system, again, that's part of the ATO process. They would look at the provisional authorization, make a determination of any controls that the provider could or couldn't meet, and decide if that's appropriate or a risk for their particular mission system.
So let's say that as you're going through the FedRAMP process, your FedRAMP ATO comes from a defense agency, let's say the Defense Logistics Agency. Does that get you anything additional in terms of reciprocity throughout the rest of the Defense Department?
So the way that we're doing that is we're actually partnering with the other communities across DoD in terms of actually issuing provisional authorizations. So if another agency within the DoD, let's say the Navy, wishes to work with a cloud service provider, they will in turn work with DISA, and we will partner with them and in terms of, you know, reviewing the documentation, the approach, et cetera. Ultimately, then the provisional authorization would then come out of DISA for that cloud provider's use. But the big advantage is more often than not, those same assessors for the Navy will be the ones supporting the ATO, the authority to operate recommendation. So those individuals are naturally being part of that evaluation process. They understand the risk all the way through and creates a win-win for everyone. We get to leverage those resources. The mission owner has a better understanding of the risk, and ultimately DoD is able to have a provisional authorization issued sooner for a cloud service provider.
I see. So those assessors will have already seen the exact same technical data packages for this product. They'll have a working understanding of what the product is. They don't need to start from ground zero.
Exactly. And our team here at DISA actually engages with those assessors in terms of actually reviewing the controls and what the risks are. And they, you know, have discussions around those to make sure that, again, it's acceptable both from an overall DoD perspective and from the mission perspective itself. So we found that that's a great winning opportunity. We've used that successfully with SPAWAR from the Navy, and we've also recently used that with Air Force, and we found that that's a great partnership between our organizations.
That's Roger Greenwell, the Director of Cybersecurity at the Defense Information Systems Agency. A short break here, and he'll be back with us to talk some more about cloud security. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Getting back to our special edition of On DoD on cloud computing within the Defense Information Systems Agency. We're focusing on cloud security in this part of the program. Roger Greenwell is joining us for this. He's the Director of Cybersecurity at DISA. As we talk about DoD provisional authorizations for commercial cloud providers and how that interacts with the government's FedRAMP process.
So as a lot of folks know, the FedRAMP program office is working on a high baseline for the rest of the government. I wonder how you imagine that fitting in with DoD's own higher impact levels. I think that would mostly be at 5 and 6, right? How much will that help vendors get into that 5 and 6 level? How much reciprocity with FedRAMP high do you think we can expect?
So with FedRAMP High, our largest goal is to, you know, try to figure out, again, how many of those specific controls will be applicable against our FedRAMP Plus baseline. So, you know, the process is, you know, still in development. The FedRAMP has, you know, published their high baseline, and we were recently part of the team to evaluate a lot of the comments that were received from industry. FedRAMP is actually working with, I believe, four different vendors currently in trying to authorize against the high baseline. And so as part of our effort in DoD, we want to look at the delta between our requirements and what's being, you know, pushed as part of FedRAMP High, and certainly minimize the number of controls that then we would have to evaluate. Now, we don't see that the FedRAMP High would ever really necessarily replace the DoD provisional authorization process, because we do have special connectivity requirements, personnel clearance requirements around systems administration, et cetera, with those higher levels. But it would certainly, we want to take advantage of any efficiencies that the FedRAMP High baseline would provide in our authorization process.
Sure. So I imagine you would want that delta to be as small as possible. Would that potentially mean that you might go back and readjust your definitions of impact levels 5 and 6 so that they conform more closely to whatever the analysis turns out to be of FedRAMP High?
I think at this point, the jury's still out on that one. We really need to do further due diligence in terms of the delta between the controls, and again, how can we take advantage of the controls that are part of FedRAMP High. Whether we would actually change the names of our impact levels is something we would have to see down the road. Certainly, as we look at, you know, in DoD, you know, we have high baselines that are, you know, our level 5 is really a high baseline for unclassified systems, and then level 6 is a high baseline for classified systems. So we would always see those two sets of requirements being different. So how we would align, then I'll call it the naming standards between FedRAMP and DoD, still remains to be seen.
I certainly don't expect you to name specific vendors, but can you give us some sense of what's in the queue waiting for provisional authorizations? I mean, did you expect to see a whole bunch more level 4s coming out soon, or maybe even level 5 and 6 provisional authorizations in the near future?
So right now we have in the queue, I would expect that we will see at least one level 4/5 coming in here very soon. As many people know, there's the collaboration Pathfinder, which has been out in the news, and certainly we're working with the DLA and Air Force on how we would go about doing a provisional authorization with Microsoft in order to support collaboration Pathfinder. So there will certainly be some forward progress on that over the next few months as well.
So the entire process we're talking about is based on the security requirements guide for cloud that DISA first issued, I believe it was in January. You guys just put out a draft release 2 version of that SRG. Can you walk us through some of the primary areas you're trying to address in that draft and what you would like industry to tell you as part of that comment period?
Okay, sure. So, you know, when we published version 1 back in January, we knew at that time it was not a perfect document, that we would be continuing to upgrade and add to the document over time. So this version is really intended as more clarification around several things. We've taken a lot of the comments that were received still as part of the first round of the publishing the SRG, and as well, you know, things that we've learned over the last few months as we moved forward and tried to incorporate, again, a greater level of detail. We really want to minimize the changes, if you will, that would occur in the SRG, because those changes could actually have an impact to the cost with the cloud service provider. So our goal is to not necessarily overall change the requirements, but again, to add some clarity. Some of the information we've clarified is how a CSP would transition as a cloud SRG is actually updated. We've basically aligned that with the FedRAMP process so that, again, as FedRAMP evolves from one release to the next release, clarifying how we see the SRG requirements and, again, aligning with the FedRAMP process. Contracting, noting the requirements, again, for a PA relative to a successful offerer. Again, you asked earlier about contracting requirements. So again, an ATO is not necessarily required for a cloud service provider to sell business to the DoD, but certainly a provisional authorization will be required for the successful offerer. And so, of course, many companies are, geared around getting their provisional authorization as early in the process as possible. In this release of the SRG, we've also expanded the privacy controls, especially as it relates to PII and PHI, continuing to evolve that section. Ports and protocols, we've got DoD guidance around the use of certain ports and protocols as they traverse the network. So we've added clarity in terms of how a cloud connection actually aligns with that guidance. Our registration processes. So one of the things that we want to make sure we can do is as systems and missions move into the cloud, that we have an accurate inventory of where those systems are, who's the provider for those, who's providing the network defense, who are the key points of contact. So we've actually added a module to our system network approval process, a system called SNAP, so that it has the ability to register cloud systems and missions as they take advantage of whether it's commercial cloud or DoD cloud. We require people to enter that information. So again, it gives us the ability to know where our missions and systems are and be able to defend that. Along with CND, we also updated the section around digital forensics in the cloud. We know that potentially incidents and compromises will happen, and so we want to make sure that we, have a clear understanding in the SRG of how they get reported, when they get reported, what are some of the steps that we would expect the cloud service provider to be doing in terms of being able to collect information and having that data available for analysis. So those are some of the key things that we've done in this particular update. Again, it's really not as much change as it is more clarification of some of the requirements in the SRG.
Right. And I think certainly one of the main objectives of the whole transition to this SRG and risk acceptance process was to speed up the process of cloud adoption. So far, can you give us any sense of what how long the process takes, even at a level two, soup to nuts, from the time you get a DoD provisional authorization / FedRAMP approval to the point where you get an ATO and you can start operating? And is it an objective of the updated SRG to speed that process up?
So the time that it takes to get from a provisional authorization to an ATO varies by, the system, the criticality of it, what its function naturally is. In those cases where the organization has worked with us through the provisional authorization process, we've seen that turnaround literally be within weeks, and by that I mean just a couple of weeks in being able to do that initial analysis. In other cases, again, it depends upon whether it's infrastructure as a service or software as a service. So infrastructure as a service, a mission owner may have a system that's operating in one location today, and they simply want to, if you will, port that application over to the commercial cloud. And in those cases, as they understand the risk of the infrastructure, they already have a solid understanding of the risk associated with their application. So they're able to take those two sets of artifacts and conditions and be able to turn around authorization quickly. But it's hard to give an average time for that because, again, there are so many variables in terms of you know, the complexity of the mission systems, the complexity of the cloud service itself. Again, is it a level 2, 4, or 5 type of application? There's really no average time frame. One of the things I can say is that, you know, from our perspective in doing the provisional authorization process, we're working to make some process changes there. We know today that our process has probably not been as fast as we would like it to. So we are taking some internal looks to see how can we speed up that process. And certainly, you know, one of our biggest goals is, you know, we don't want to spend a lot of time reevaluating controls. And so one of the biggest things that helps that is the cloud providers in making sure that their documentation is correct and is detailed. When their security plan has that level of detail that's needed and the 3PAO can come in and perform their assessment and align their results with the actual details in the system security plan, it certainly makes our process in doing the evaluations a lot quicker and a lot smoother.
And Roger, I guess the last thing I'd be curious about in our remaining time is, out of the DoD mission owners who've used this process, are they mainly using commercial cloud to migrate, you know, legacy DoD owned systems into a new cloud environment, or more to build new IT services from scratch in the cloud from the get go?
So I think it's, Jared, it's actually a combination. As you look at some of what's occurring, you know, mentioned the Collaboration Pathfinder initiative, naturally that's really bringing, I'll say, new capabilities, if you will, to email and in some sense unified capabilities to the cloud. And so that's bringing, I would categorize that as really new mission systems, new capabilities. In terms of other mission systems, it has been pretty much porting across existing applications. DISA took advantage of the Amazon Cloud and ported our information assurance support environment. It's open to the public. We've moved that into the commercial cloud, and we've actually moved portions of our level 4 offering into the commercial cloud as well. So certainly we want to, you know, take advantage of it for whatever purpose and fit that customers want to see. And we know that, again, there's different use cases for that. DoD does, you know, is making a solid commitment to the cloud and the industry solutions that are, you know, supported in the cloud. We recognize, you know, that there's efficiencies that industry can bring to bear for the department, and we certainly want to take advantage of those efficiencies. Of course, one of our challenges that we continue to work through is making sure that we balance the level of security and the level of risk with being able to create those efficiencies. So I think we're starting to see some success in this area, and certainly looking forward to better opportunities for DoD to take advantage of commercial cloud in the future.
That's Roger Greenwell, Director of Cybersecurity at the Defense Information Systems Agency. More on cloud computing within DISA when we come back from another break. Julie Mintz, the chief of DISA's cloud service branch, will join us to talk about MilCloud, DoD's private cloud. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome back to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, a special edition of On DoD this hour, as we hear from three guests at the Defense Information Systems Agency, getting the latest on several aspects of cloud computing. They're also joining us for a live web chat with our listeners and readers. Our next guest is Julie Mintz, the branch chief for DISA's cloud service. Among the projects in her portfolio, the MilCloud program.
So MilCloud is the DoD private cloud. It's hosted in the Defense Enterprise Computing Centers and is provided by leveraging existing capacity services contracts for compute, storage, and networking. It's available on both unclassified and classified networks and is currently being used by projects from the military services, the defense agencies, and the command commands.
And a lot of folks will also have heard of RACE, the Rapid Access Computing Environment, another sort of compute as a service product that you guys offer. What's the difference between the two, and is RACE going away as MilCloud matures?
So RACE is part of the family of MilCloud. It is not a separate offering anymore. Instead, it's a way of utilizing what is now MilCloud in order to support your test and development environment. It comes along with a little more handholding and support. MilCloud itself is what we consider pure infrastructure as a service, where the mission partner is responsible for most of the management. With RACE, there was more support provided by the DISA program office. However, you can utilize MilCloud for your development, test, pre-prod, and production environments.
Okay, so you mentioned a pretty broad customer base at the very beginning of the interview. Can you talk a little bit more about the adoption that you've seen in the roughly, I don't know, what's it been, about 18 months since MilCloud's been up and running? Who is using it? How widespread? Correct me on that date if I'm wrong.
It's something like that. It's about a year for the classified and a year and a half for the unclassified. Our biggest users are the Defense Logistics Agency, the Air Force, and DISA itself. It's the underlying infrastructure for the Defense Collaboration Services. We've seen an uptick in adoption over the course of the past year, especially the last 6 months. What we're finding is a lot of people kind of get their toes wet, trying out test projects, seeing how it works for them, adopting their processes, ensuring that their authorizing official is comfortable with the concepts of shared risk responsibility, and then there tends to be a growth in usage.
And when you tell your customers about kind of the capabilities of MilCloud, what are the main selling points? What do they get out of it that they wouldn't be able to achieve by hosting their own data, doing their own compute, handling everything themselves?
I think what they find is they get some of the benefits of standard hosting in the deck, being able to depend on the security and the robust infrastructure there, while also getting the flexibility of managing their own implementation to the degree that they want. It does have the ability to scale more easily and more quickly than some of the other capabilities they may be used to. And it gives them the ability to kind of control their own destiny, set up what they want so that they can get the capabilities they need out of their own system.
And once you do have an IT services instantiation inside of MilCloud as a customer, what sort of controls do you have over the services that are being provided to you? And how rapidly can you scale up, scale down? What can you add? What can you subtract from what you're getting?
Well, for the basic infrastructure and your compute, storage, and memory, you can order modifications through the portal, and those are implemented as soon as the funding has been processed. So we're able to deploy capability within 7 minutes once the funding has been applied. It may take longer for an initial customer to get the network connectivity set up, but once you're an existing customer, making those modifications to capacity are pretty much real time.
In your pricing lists, I'm seeing something that's basically described as the base product versus MilCloud Plus. Can you describe a little bit about the differences between those two?
Right. The base product is the infrastructure as a service. It's that compute and storage memory capability. MilCloud Plus is the equivalent of DISA's basic services running on top of MilCloud. For those people who aren't comfortable managing their own VDCs, they can hire DISA to perform some of the application administration.
Why would someone within the DoD choose to utilize MilCloud versus going out to, say, a commercial cloud hosting provider? I mean, is it mainly the security? What are the sort of the advantages that they would get from MilCloud?
Well, I think in some cases, MilCloud is kind of the starter kit for the cloud. People who are currently hosted in the DEX, making a first move to virtualization, can move to MilCloud first, get set up, and then take a second step to commercial cloud after they have a contract in place, after they've seen that the capabilities they want have a DoD provisional authorization. So we don't view ourselves as being competitive with the commercial cloud, but instead being an additional offering. One that's available now is available on both the unclassified and classified networks, and is a place people can get cloud capabilities up and running and get their processes refined.
And speaking of those provisional authorizations, we heard earlier in the hour from your colleague Roger Greenwell about all the Cloud Security Requirements Guide and how that applies to commercial providers. How does that all relate to MillCloud? Are you abiding by the same security models and controls, and who oversees that and ensures that that's happening?
Well, the same authorizing official who signs out the Cloud Computing Security Requirements Guide and issues the DoD provisional authorizations is also the authorizing official for MillCloud and signs out our authority to operate. We do meet the same controls, or we fall under the DoD risk management framework, which is compliant with the NIST Special Pub 800-53, which is the FedRAMP set of specifications. And then we follow the essentially the FedRAMP Plus requirements that come from the additional CNSSI requirements for DoD systems. So while we don't go through FedRAMP specifically, it's the same assessors evaluating us and the same authorizing official who is issuing us our ATO.
So to sum that up, would it be right to say that even though you're not following the exact same to the letter cloud security requirements guide that industry is being asked to follow, it's all based on the same standards, NIST 800-53, et cetera?
That's correct.
Also, on a related topic, your boss, Tony Montemarano, spilled the beans a couple weeks ago at an event when he said that y'all are working on a MillCloud version 2. And in that version, there's going to be more of a reliance on industry. He said, I believe his exact words were, we're going commercial. Can you tell us any more about what that means and what more participation industry might have in a forthcoming version of MillCloud?
So we are committed to supporting the current MillCloud, which we're now calling MillCloud 1.0, while we work the plans and evaluate our options for MillCloud 2.0, which will be the next generation. Right now, all options are on the table for that. It may be deployed on or off premise, commercial solutions, a leasing model, any delivery model is on the table. What we're doing is taking a look at the feedback from the MillCloud 1.0 customers, looking at the evolving cybersecurity and cloud technology environment, and reviewing the responses to the RFI that the DISA CTO put out last year for commercial cloud integration models. That evaluation will lead to the selection of an acquisition strategy, but we definitely want commercial participation, and we anticipate that the solution will be a commercial one.
In terms of added capabilities or new capabilities in MillCloud 2, is there anything in particular that you've targeted thus far?
I think what we're looking for is the full set of cloud characteristics. So metered billing, full elasticity, more flexibility, which is some of the benefits that the commercial providers bring, is what we're looking to have available for our mission partners.
Just so I understand, are some of those things lacking in the current version of MillCloud in terms of elasticity and metered billing?
Well, it's not as granular as we would like it because of some of the limitations of our underlying contract vehicles and the way the funding is handled for DoD systems. Right now, we're unable to scale up and down and bill people in, like, you know, 5-minute increments. So that is something that people have requested, where it's a very granular units like that. It's something that may be possible for DoD systems running a commercial cloud, and it's something that we want to pursue.
Let me ask a question about rates, which you guys are now publishing publicly, which a lot of people appreciate. As they're posted in that PDF document, they're just static base rates. And I'm wondering if you also offer volume discounts for very large users of MillCloud, or is that the same rate that everybody pays?
Right now, we do not have any volume discounts. They all pay the same rate.
Okay, and let me finish up with a related question. We've known for a while that the intention in another cloud project, Defense Enterprise Email, for a 2.0 version of that, the intention has been to move it to a commercial cloud hosting service. You guys just issued a request for information on that last week. Can you tell us a little bit about the sorts of things you're wanting to learn from industry and where you might be headed with DEE 2.0?
I think similar to what we're doing with MilCloud 2.0, what we really want to do is understand what's available in the commercial marketplace, how they can address some of the feedback that we've received from current customers, and how we can take advantage of their ability to drive rates down over time, have more flexible billing models, perhaps have technology insertion over time.
In that RFI, one of the main things that jumped out at me was that there's a target anyway of reducing or cutting costs by 50% compared to what DIS is currently charging DoD customers in DEE 1.0. I mean, is that just a long stretch goal, or have you begun to see things out in industry that make you really think that's definitely achievable in terms of bringing costs down?
I can't speak specifically for enterprise email, but in general, what we've seen is considerable price cuts over time, that competition between providers kind of drives a race to provide lower and lower costs, and that there are efficiencies gained as you get increased usage that can be given back to the customers.
That's Julie Mintz, the Cloud Service Branch Chief at the Defense Information Systems Agency, one of three guests joining us this hour to bring us up to speed on cloud computing within DISA. One more break, and when we come back, Carrie Burris, the project manager for Forge.mil, will be with us. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Wrapping up our series of conversations with leaders at the Defense Information Systems Agency about cloud computing. Earlier in the program, we heard from Roger Greenwell about DISA's cloud security process and from Julie Mintz about MilCloud. We'll round out the hour with Carrie Burris. He is the program manager for Forge.mil, DoD's collaborative platform for software development.
Forge.mil is a central software development and collaboration platform that consists of Software Forge and Project Forge. Software Forge enables the collaborative development and distribution of open source software and DoD community source software. Software Forge is a free service, and it's available on both the unclass and class systems. Project Forge provides the same tools as Software Forge, but for programs that need to restrict access. Project Forge is a fee-for-service capability and is currently available on the unclass network. Forge has been operational since 2009. We've got over 40,000 users working on over 1,200 projects. The capability that exists in Forge today is centered on software development, software version control, code management, and release management. The core product that Software Forge and Project Forge are built on is CollabNet's Team Forge, which is a recognized ALM, one of the best in breeds, actually. There are two types of tools in Forge today, development tools and communication tools.
And you mentioned with Project Forge that the main purpose of that is so people have more granular control over who can see their work, basically. What are some of the reasons why developers would want to have those access controls in place?
Well, a lot of developers are doing work that they just can't share. There may be some proprietary reasons. There's licenses agreements, also doing classified work that they just do not want to share with other users.
And do you have any sense of what proportion of your users are using that free service, Software Forge, vice the fee-for-service version of it, Project Forge?
Yeah, so I think that we have about 23,000 users using Software Forge. The rest are using the pay service, ProjectForge.
And we should say that even in the free service, it's not as though people's work is completely accessible and available to the entire world the way it would be in, you know, SourceForge or one of the other public websites. It's even that version is restricted.
Right. It's restricted to the DoD community and people supporting the DoD.
From a project management standpoint, what's the virtue of developing your software in this, you know, open community sort of way, rather than in sort of the development silos that the department has been famous for in the past?
So what it does is gives everyone visibility. It brings the entire community together, and they have visibility across the entire project space. There's visibility of software assets that promote reuse. You're able to identify gaps in capability, eliminate redundancy and duplication of effort. And then there's the whole ideal of code reuse and code quality improvements.
And for people who aren't familiar with those terms, talk a bit about what code reuse really means. I mean, it's about not having to reinvent the wheel every time you start a new software project, right?
Exactly. Individuals are able to share. They can pick up a piece of code that someone's already developed and insert it into the code that they're working on, or they don't have to start from the start. They're able to just reuse the code.
And I don't know if anything particularly comes to mind, but are there any, let's say, case studies that you want to share in terms of IT systems or projects that were born and developed in Forge and went on to be successful and used in the department?
Well, there are many projects enjoying benefits of software reuse. I think the most downloaded software application on SoftwareForge are run by two individuals who saw a need and filled that need. These two project managers have provided other members of the DoD tools to support information assurance requirements, as well as automation of training records. So there's a lot of reuse going on.
And if we're reusing code, one would expect the logical conclusion of that to be we're actually saving some money and developing faster. Have you guys measured much of that in terms of what an average project in Forge sees in terms of real cost savings or accelerated development?
Well, we've actually had some customers say that they saw an 85% reduction in costs. We've had projects that have indicated savings ranging from $18,000 per project for small teams, and a small team being 1 to 15 developer, to as much as $1.2 million per project for enterprise groups of 300 to 2,000 developers. These are measurable, tangible benefits that our customers, users are finding with Forge.mil. There's also intangible benefits to using Forge. The development community sparks creativity and innovation impossible to attain otherwise. Forge.mil brings with it many of the social and technology-related benefits of open-source software communities, inspiring peer networks and strengthening software quality, agility, and innovation.
And so since you're taking advantage of open source software in building these projects, or your developers are anyway, does that software flow go in both directions? Are your developers then contributing back to the open source community after they succeed in developing something?
Our developers are using Forge primarily for the DoD community and users that support the DoD.
You mentioned toward the beginning of our conversation the commercial CollabNet software that Forge.mil is based on. I know they rolled out a big upgrade this week, which I think you're also implementing within Forge.mil. You want to talk about some of the new features and upgrades that your users are going to be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, so last weekend we updated SoftwareForge and ProjectForge to CollabNet's Team Forge 7.2. What this upgrade did was provide a number of user-requested enhancements, which included planning boards to visualize data. There was inline editing of bugs and requirements, and many other what you might consider small user interface improvements. In addition to the upgrade in software, we actually went through what we would consider an upgrade in infrastructure. Forge.mil is now hosted in DISA's infrastructure as a service cloud solution, MilCloud. Within the next few months, we plan to integrate Git, which is an open source distributed version control system, and Datamart, which is an improved metrics reporting tool.
Beyond those improvements that we just talked about, anything else in the future of Forge.mil that you want to let us know about?
Yes. So with the upgrade of CollabNet Team Forge 7.2 complete, we're looking forward to gathering new requirements through a Forge.mil user community advisory board to develop, integrate, and deploy even more user-driven features. Going forward, we hope to work on a tighter integration with DISA Cloud Services and use cloud orchestration tools to speed the delivery of software and provide our users with a more seamless continuous delivery platform.
That's Kerry Burris, the program manager for Forge.mil, one of three guests who joined us this hour from the Defense Information Systems Agency with the latest on cloud computing within DISA. Thanks also to Roger Greenwell, DISA's cybersecurity director, and Julie Mintz, the cloud computing service branch chief. All three of our guests also agreed to join us for a live web Q&A with our listeners. We'll post an archived version of that text conversation, along with the interviews you just heard, at federalnewsradio.com. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks, as always, for joining us. I'm Jared Serbio. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.